If you want to explore how businesses actually use the massive amount of data they are collecting about you every day, you have landed on the right podcast. We look at the tech, people, and the processes cutting-edge businesses are using to collect data and answer the question, I have the data, now what? Here is your host, Asha Saxena.
Welcome, divers. This is your host, Asha Saxena, for yet another episode of Dive with Data. We've been talking about big data, artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning, digitalization, and now blockchain. Technology convergence is the coming together of various spheres of technologies. Big data analytics, social, mobile, and cloud all meet in a single process or device. So how should organizations be responding to this? What and how these technologies be changing our lives and impacting our healthcare, quality, cost, and most importantly, the care? Today on Dive with Data, we'll be discussing converging technologies and much more with our guest, Anthony Scrifiano, Senior Vice President, Chief Data Scientist at Dun & Bradstreet. Dun & Bradstreet, 176-year-old leading provider of business information with one of the largest database offering derived from a global database of 300 million companies facilitating for business-to-business commerce. We'll discuss how Anthony, in his role, experiences the evolution of technologies and recognizes that leading technologies are now converging and responding to convergent technologies. Can businesses hide behind innovation, spend huge budgets purchasing latest and greatest technologies, or they should be focusing on the right things? While we are getting exposed to the cutting edge technologies, we can forget that we are in the business to serve customers. Business need to laser focus on being customer centric, use convergence to better streamline the customer care journey. Data should dictate the experiences you serve your customers, in this case, our patients, and when and where, how these experiences are getting accumulated by your customers or by your patients. It's about creating omnichannel, giving patients the experience and the care they deserve. The positive impact of technology is clear. Organizations that make a digital transition experience all of these benefits of technology, trends, and innovation, and getting the rewards of having fans as their customers. Making the move promises a higher caliber of progress across the board. So, without further delay, let's welcome our guest today, Anthony Scrifiano. Welcome, Anthony, to the show. So nice to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Before we start, I want to congratulate you on the award you just received for being the Chief Data Officer of the year 2018 by the CDO Club. The CDO Club is the world's largest communities of C-level executives, Chief Data Officer and Digital Officers, and the last two award winners were the Global Chief Data Officer of IBM and also Dr. DJ Patel, U.S. Chief Data Scientist of White House Science and Technology Policy. Just great names and great background of these people. How do you feel about this award and being recognized by the side of such achievers?
I'm obviously really humbled in that group. It's an amazing group. The CDO Club is an amazing organization. They bring together people literally from all over the world to talk about data science and to talk about the management of data in organizations. There's so many different names for these titles, but it's all about dealing with big data in organizations, topics like AI, which we'll talk about today. It's a great place to come and sort of take the pulse of your peer organizations on what are they worrying about, what are they thinking about. And it was just a tremendous honor to be recognized by them.
So your role in Dun & Bradstreet is the Chief Data Scientist. This role didn't really exist a few years back. How did you get involved into this role? And what does this role entail for you as a Chief Data Scientist? And what does it entail for the company, the organization, Dun & Bradstreet?
So the first thing to realize is there's lots of people that have very senior roles that deal with data in Dun & Bradstreet because that's what we do, right? So I'm certainly not the only one. The importance of the role that I have was to broaden the aperture of data and data science across the organization. So I'm not part of really any line of business. I'm part of every line of business. There's a lot of collaboration that is required to make a statement like that. So I have counterparts in different parts of the organization that I lean on and rely upon very heavily to get things done. But it's part of the new way of thinking about data as pervasive within an organization, not only in the products and services that we sell, but in the evolving capabilities that we have to understand our customers' needs. So it's a really a kind of a rich broadening of the thinking of data within my organization.
And what, you know, the data company, Dun & Bradstreet is a data company. And this is a good time for data companies because you're ahead of the game in collecting data. So talk to me about Dun & Bradstreet. What are you guys doing which you think would be revolutionary for industries to really look at you and take advantage of companies like yours?
It's a big question. And I think the first thing is to realize we're not just a big database. So, yes, of course, we have lots of data, and that is critical to what we do, thinking about the essence of any of these decisions that need to be made about business. You want to go to a place where a curated set of very highly dynamic data that is as close as you can get to a holistic view of a company on Earth. That's a great start, and that's what we do, but we do much more than that, so we draw inference from that. We're not certainly not smarter than a lot of the customers that we deal with and their best data scientists, but we can see things that they can't. And we're able to make decisions based on what we can see that are based on our experience with lots of other companies like them and with how this data has been changing. We've been in business for this is our 176th year. There are about 27 million companies in the United States. There's about 11 that are that old. So we've got some great giants upon whose shoulders we stand doing this. And I'm really proud to be seeing this evolution here from a database to making sense out of that and collaborating with our customers on their biggest problems.
Congratulations on the longevity of the company and also to the people who actually make it work. So before we get started, I want to really talk about artificial intelligence. And it's been around for such a long time, and it means different things to different people. What does AI mean to you, and how do you really define it?
Well, what I did some time ago was to look at the peer-reviewed literature and how the community at large defines this term. And big surprise, there are different definitions. So this is a term that has both general and specific meaning. And to some AI practitioners who are Bayesians, they are very, very focused on Bayesian inference. To others who are using non-regressive methods, it can be deep believe or deep learn. To others, it can be a cognitive approach. If you try to zoom up and just speak like a human being to another human being, artificial intelligence in general is a set of computer capabilities that are designed to either mimic human intent, behave rationally according to the assessment of humans, to serve humans in ways that other humans would otherwise serve them, or to help humans in making decisions that they need to make. So there's that human element of it. Now, having said that, we tend to anthropomorphize a lot. We use a lot of words like intelligence and learning. We have to remember that there's no intelligence here. There's no learning here because there's no sentient being at the other end of the artificial intelligence. It's a set of algorithms. So it's very important to understand what your set of algorithms does and what it doesn't do and what the preconditions are in order to be able to use whatever method you're using. But think serving humans or behaving like humans.
You know, we've seen artificial intelligence from the very beginning of time at some form, and it's been around for a long time. And Star Wars and Star Trek encompassed, you know, so we were all excited about AI, you know, when you're watching these shows. Tell me about how and why AI has become so much more now. We are seeing that in healthcare. We're seeing it in all aspects of life, you know, how we are going to shop and how we're going to interact with information. Why is suddenly there is a whole hype about AI?
So certainly it's been in literature way before it's been in reality. And you brought up Star Trek and Star Wars, and I'm a big Star Trek fan, so I'll use that as a base for responding to your question. The computer in Star Trek really was just a way to look up. It was Wikipedia. It was a way to look up all the information known. And they primarily, occasionally, they'd use the computer to try to self-destruct the ship or something. But in general, the primary role of the computer was to bring in the knowledge of the Federation when they needed it. And so it was a way to look things up. You look at Star Trek, and then you compare it to Star Wars, mm-hmm. and now you have droids. You have autonomous robots, basically, that not only have knowledge, but they have the ability to reason from that knowledge and to try to do some of those things I just said, serve humans, behave like humans, project human intent. So there's more of the common definition of artificial intelligence in Star Wars, the way you see the droids operating. But we also have to remember this is fiction. And those are people. And just like there was the voice of Majel Barrett behind the computer in Star Trek, and there's a whole bunch of people behind all the different droids in Star Wars, it's Hollywood. And Hollywood and reality are very different. So we have to be a little bit humble about what can be achieved by our digital agents today. They can, there's something called a Turing test. Alan Turing, one of the forefathers of computer science, projected this test where a machine can be perceived as intelligent when a human cannot determine that he's interacting with a machine by asking it questions. And our machines are starting to come close to that Turing test. I have great nieces and nephews that think Siri is the smartest person in the world, right? Or Alexa or whatever. There is no person there, and we know that. But sometimes we behave, we'll get upset with Siri for trying to call the wrong phone number or whatever. When that happens, you're sort of in mind passing that Turing test. Even when you pass that Turing test, there's still a machine behind it. There's still an algorithm behind it. And we have to be very careful that we don't start giving up things that we ought not to be giving up to our digital agents, because our mind has been convinced that somehow this is a living thing here that I'm interacting with. Mm-hmm. Be really careful. We wouldn't do that consciously, but we might do it subconsciously. I do it all the time. We all do it in different ways. That my GPS on my car offers different routes to me, and sometimes I'm lazy, and I say, well, just pick the number one route. And maybe you ought to think about what those three routes are. Maybe you would have driven past something more interesting if you went the other way, or, you know, there might be some other things that you know that it doesn't know that could change your experience. But we're all lazy. We're doing too many things at once. It's not that we're lazy. It's that we're busy. And we give up ground to our digital agents without realizing we've done so. I would suggest that we be careful with that.
You know, you talk about it's Hollywood and it's movies, and but how close is science and artificial intelligence could really come to understanding your behavior? You know, the worry I was, you know, one of my classes at Columbia Medical School, Mailman Public School of Health, the students asked me about this debate which Elon Musk started about, you know, there should be worry about or concern about artificial intelligence. And my response to them was that I'm on the side of Mark Zuckerberg, where he said, you know, you can't be scared of science, but you have to be careful, of course. But how far? What are your thoughts on how?
I think they're both right. So, and I'm not trying to be to weasel out of it. I can argue either of those positions, and Stephen Hawking chimed in on this, and, you know, some great minds who really know what they're talking about. Maybe we should listen to them and not me. But I will tell you that it's somewhat easy to take either of those sides, depending on what you want to believe as preconditions. The most important thing, I think, is to keep our heads up and to be aware of what we're giving away. So I'll give you an example in medicine. We've had robotic surgery for quite some time now, and there's a convergence in robotic surgery and cognitive AI and other types of artificial intelligence, where there are methods to watch what humans do with the advice given to them by machines, and then to change our advice in the future to be more likely to be accepted by the human. So if I were a conscious being as the AI agent in this sense, I would say, I don't know what that human's doing, but I can watch when he takes my advice and when he doesn't, and I can try to give him advice that he's more likely to take. And these types of methods can find their way into the surgical suite. Now, at some level, that might feel like a good idea. There are choices that surgeons have to make at times. I'm going to do this before I do that, right? I don't want to get into all of the... there's a lot of bad humor here, like all vital signs eventually stabilize. But, if the patient's going to die and this other thing might cause some other very serious thing, but not death, I'm going to go after the one that's going to not kill them first, right? I don't say out loud that that's what I'm doing. I just do it. You can imagine a machine watching, being given advice to go do B and choosing to do A instead, learning that the reasons why A was done instead relate to sustaining the life of the patient as opposed to the functionality of the patient. And then given a choice later between two different pieces of advice, choose life over functionality. That's great. But now play it forward, and sooner or later someone's going to say, you know, we're talking about cauterizing blood vessels, we're talking about protecting nerves, we're talking about doing things that really require not only a lot of precision, but often very quick action and very quick decisions. And sooner or later, the machine can make a decision faster than it can explain it to you. And if you would just let the machine make the decision, it will make a better decision than you will over time. Here's the tables that prove that over time, these algorithms make better decisions than a randomized group of surgeons. And so we should let the algorithm make this kind of a decision because it requires quickness. It requires agility. You just stepped over a line. You just gave over some rights to a machine. Abstract that to war and deciding whether or not to launch an attack. Abstract that to a self-driving car that is going to have an accident and has to choose which accident it's going to have. Abstract that to an airplane where the autoflight system, instead of giving up control back to the pilot, says, no, this is what we're going to do. These are pieces of ground that we give up to our algorithms if we choose to do so, but at what cost? Mm. So I'd be really careful. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying don't let it happen by accident.
Right.
Pay attention.
Have a conscious delivery of how you're going to use.
And what you've chosen to give up.
Mm.
I don't want to get political here, but when we go to an airport, we have given up a lot of our rights to privacy and so forth, but we have done so in order to get more protection. That's the argument, right? That happened very publicly and very openly, and we didn't wake up in the morning and all of a sudden everything changed. To some extent it did, but there was very public debate about that. There needs to be public debate when we cross these imaginary lines in medicine, in anything, so that it's not happening sort of accidentally, a little bit at a time, like water on a stone, and then you wake up one day and all of a sudden a surgeon can't intervene.
Right.
Because the machine says, no, I've locked you out right now. You know, I'm busy. Come back in a minute.
Right.
That's not a good day.
Right. That's a great point. And, you know, that kind of instantly worries me about the privacy, you know, as you talk about all these technologies coming together and inclusion and non-exclusion. Privacy is a big issue. And with GDPR, there's a whole lot of awareness about, at least in Europe, that they're going to make their data private. For our audience who doesn't know GDPR or talk about different privacy regulation, can you talk about what's happening in the world with data privacy, and is that enough?
Well, I think we have to start, I hate to do this, but we have to start with defining privacy, because that doesn't have the same definition all over the world. So we're sitting here having this conversation in North America, and in North America, there aren't really a lot of privacy laws, believe it or not. There's some dealing with email and so forth and marketing, and there's do not call lists, but nothing like what you find in other parts of the world. We live our lives with a certain, we'll call them reasonable expectations of privacy. You presume that if you leave the room, I won't rifle through your stuff and find your passport and look at your year of birth or whatever. That would be an invasion of your privacy. But if you go somewhere and they require your passport as identification, you realize that the person looking at that can see your year of birth and all of that. So we have this sort of dichotomy of what we mean by privacy and how much of it we want or expect in different situations? Can your employer look at your email when you're not around or even when you are around? There's expectations there. There are electronic privacy agreements that we sign. There's a whole, really a very vast array of overlapping and sometimes self-contradictory and mutually contradictory pieces of advice and law and regulation that we need to follow. You take this to other parts of the world. There's some parts of the world, I'm not going to start naming countries, where there's no expectation of privacy. There is the understanding that everything you do is discoverable. You should live your life as a responsible person, and then you don't have to worry about that. And if someone were to exploit your privacy in some way, for example, realizing how many children you have and then somehow trying to decide whether or not to hire you based on the number of children, then we'll take care of that as a one-off. We're not going to overregulate because that might happen. We're going to stop that from happening in other ways. So getting back to data, GDPR is an interesting piece of regulation. There were and are many other pieces of regulation that try to regulate privacy. This one has some interesting nuances in that it talks about the curators of the data as well as the providers of the data, and it also extends to the way in which that privacy might be infringed upon outside of Europe. So it's got some pretty long legs, and it's dyadic. It has both sides of the relationship of providing and receiving the data in it. Really interesting in that regard, and that's a lot of the reason why some organizations are struggling to comply with this regulation. We've been focused on it for quite some time, so I wouldn't say that we're struggling. I would say that we're very, very focused on it. It's a big, big piece of legislation, and it has very long legs. What's happening in the world right now in general is probably a shift toward more awareness of how data is being used, more intolerance for it being used in unanticipated ways. So think about the Cambridge Analytica thing. And more focus on the social cost of these quote-unquote data breaches. Many of the times when you read about a data breach, there was no breach. There was data that was sold and used for a purpose that wasn't either understood or intended. It's not a breach. It was sold, right? It was maybe a misuse. It was maybe a contractual understanding. Maybe it was an abuse. We're very, very focused on this right now. But when we light the torches and we start storming the castle saying we want privacy, you have to realize that everybody holding a torch doesn't actually mean the same thing when they say privacy. And some of that privacy that you say you want will make some things stop working in ways that you expect them to work. So this is not a binary thing. This is not a, I want my privacy, and I'll tell you, I'm going to keep beating this drum until I get it. You need to think about the areas of gray there, and also you need to think more broadly about the community in which it's being used or not used. It's not a simple subject. This is going to continue to evolve probably long after both of us are happily retired.
It's a long conversation about privacy every time I get into that topic. Tell us your three takeaways for the audience. As we come to the close of the episode, I want to make sure that the audience learns something from our talk and maybe they can go back to work and use it. What would be the three takeaways for them to learn from what your experience has been and what you've learned in your career?
So my first piece of advice would be humble. Resist the thought that you can either know all you need to know or that you can just go buy everything you need to buy to solve a problem. Realize that the world is changing in ways that we, as a digerati, the people who use all of this digital technology, don't completely understand. So be humble about what's achievable and realistic about the investments you're making in time and talent and treasure to make sure that you are consciously moving where you're moving and not getting there by accident. The second thing I would say is to be inclusive. So it's very easy to get insulated and convince yourself how smart you are, how much you know, how good your people are, how awesome your innovation is. Unless you open up that aperture and look at what other people are doing, in an inclusive way and realize that some of you may be working on the same problem differently, you run the risk of trying to reinvent the wheel. The cost of doing nothing is not nothing anymore. The cost of doing nothing is getting increasingly far behind at a very fast rate. So it's very important to be paying attention to your customers, your competitors, the way the field is changing, and have conscious steps to include that outside-in perspective. And then the last thing I would say is to always have a change management element in your organization. Don't just think of bringing in people. Think of upgrading the skills of the people you have. Think of understanding how you can defend what you're not doing. Always think about how that environment is constantly changing. Otherwise, you're constantly going to be a fast follower. You're going to be chasing the last cybersecurity attack. You're going to be chasing the last thing your competitor did to outpace you with some new technique or some new data capability. We have to think about change as something that is certain to occur and get out in front of that change as much as we can.
Great. Thank you so much for the insight. I'm sure we all learned a lot from the conversation today. Thank you for coming.
I certainly enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Just a great discussion about evolving technologies and how these technologies are going to change our world. I have to confess, R2-D2 is still my favorite robot from Star Wars. But do we have to worry about robots taking over our world? Artificial intelligence and algorithms powered by big data analytics already influence how we shop, what we watch, and increasingly, how we work. It's important to point out that people and organizations are not passive observers of the change sweeping our society. Technologies are not an autonomous force beyond our control. All of us, developers, users, consumers, and policymakers, we all have the power to determine how these technologies evolve, how they're applied, and ultimately how they impact people and societies. We have to promote thoughtful and responsive adoption of AI as one of our duties and creating common language and shared understanding. With that, we come to the end of the episode, Dive with Data. Until next time, this is Asha Saxena. Thank you.
We just scratched the surface of data with today's episode. If you want to join in the full conversation, check us out at divewithdata.com or follow us on Twitter at divewithdata. And as always, leave us a rating and review if you enjoy the show. Your feedback is what keeps this podcast going. Have a great day.